In 2012, there was an attack on the Saudi oil giant Saudi Aramco and other companies in the region. The hacktivist group, the Cutting Sword of Justice, took immediate responsibility for the attack and then promptly disappeared. What was left behind were infected machines at Saudi Aramco. All of them had their hard drives wiped clean by the Shamoon malware. Shamoon is known as a wiper, and like Caddy Wiper or Double Zero, Isaac Wiper, Kill Disk, and Meteor, to only name a few, wipers not only infect the hard drives, they write over the hard drives with ones and zeros so that the data can never be recovered. Wipers have been used by Russia, Iran, North Korea, and other bad actors. Some of the most recent attacks have been launched by Russia during its invasion of Ukraine. Imagine critical infrastructure systems wiped of their data, their operating systems. That's what happened to Saudi Aramco. Oil rigs were shut down because the systems were wiped clean. Clearly, this has the potential to be devastating. But what if the security controls you have in place today could be turned against you? That feature that not only isolates malware on your system, but also removes that malware, what if that could be turned and used as a weapon against your enterprise? Or that cloud-based backup system that is designed to delete old copies, what if it deletes all the copies instead? This is a story of how a researcher turns commercial and commonly used EDRs and cloud-based backup systems into wipers against the very data that they're designed to protect. I'm Robert Famosi. This is Error Code.
My name is Or Yair, and I'm currently the security research team lead at SafeBridge.
I met Or at Sector 2023 in Toronto, and he had not one, but two presentations. The first talk, Akito, turning EDRs into malicious wipers using zero-day exploits, was also presented at Black Hat Europe earlier in the year. Or's second talk at Sector 2023 is entitled OneDrive, Double Agent, Clouded OneDrive Turns Sides. That talk takes the idea of the first, that security tools can be turned against you, and applies it to cloud backups. Both talks were based on research Orr did on behalf of the company SafeBridge.
SafeBridge is a BAS company, which stands for Breach and Attack Simulation. Basically, breach and attack simulation is, you can think of it, for starters, like some sort of automated pen testing, one that is really powerful. So instead of continuously validating yourself manually with writing exploits and running the whole thing on your own, we create a huge playbook of attacks, which is created by our research teams. And then it lets you the ability to keep validating yourself against these attacks in your organizations continuously. You can schedule some of them. You can schedule all of them to run on certain days and certain hours. You can see what are the results, which security products stopped it or not, and what they report. And also you get rules to add to your security products in order to improve your security posture.
Both talks at Sector involved using security tools already on a system, but converting them for use by an attacker. So, would it be safe to say that these two talks could be classified into living off the land attacks?
Yeah, you can classify it like that. But usually when we talk about living off the land attacks, then it's usually spoken about when we talk about more specific and small things. But these are really comprehensive attacks from the beginning to their end.
In the first talk at Sector, Orr talked about antivirus protection being co-opted in the endpoint protection on a network system. I'm curious, how did Orr come upon this research?
I didn't know that this is going to be my job before I got into that. And I didn't know how much I have interest in that. But I started as just a normal security researcher that works to find vulnerabilities in certain places. But when it got to SafeBridge, I was really given to the opportunity to just sit and think about ideas that would blow people's minds to like to leave their mouths open, you know, to show what's wrong in how we protect ourselves today. And if and do that in order to help defenders to create better detection methods and help us being protected. So in both cases, I just said, okay, I want to take something which is considered to be very known and very normal to deal with, I would say, like EDRs and antiviruses have proper detection and prevention methods against wipers and ransomwares. But I wanted to show how the way we think today might not be the only way. And my way of thinking was always what I can maybe use, but nobody suspects that somebody will use it. Nobody looks at that way.
I'm curious whenever I hear security products themselves have vulnerabilities. Like, didn't the company, a security company, check its own products before releasing them into the wild?
First of all, I'm not sure that I would say like if maybe we shouldn't accept the like the protection platforms. I just think that we have still a long way to go because we now think in a really standard approach of just someone that is trying to do the normal bad thing. But I've shown that we can that the bad things can be done in not normal ways too.
I'm just wondering if it's more that the products themselves are doing what they should be doing, what they were designed to do, and now an attacker's coming in and having them co-opt to do other things. Yeah, we need to be aware of that, rather than just accepting that the EDRs are doing everything that they can on our defense. Before we get into that, what's Orr's definition of wiping versus deletion? There's a difference.
When we delete something in an operating system, and for instance, if we'll talk about Windows, then what happens is that an API call, for instance, when we delete a file, we call the delete file API call. It is being called, and then the handler for that call in the kernel is being called as a result. Then the kernel goes to a certain place on the hard drive that is called MFT, which stands for the master file table in the NTFS file system. And in this table, the kernel marks a certain entry as free. Now, this entry is only a pointer to the actual file content. So what we do when we delete a file is really just to delete the pointer to it and not the content of the file itself. And the difference between that and wiping something is that when we wipe something, we also remove the content of the file itself. But potentially deletion can be escalated to a wipe, because if you're thinking about it, you'll realize that can't just mark MFT entries forever and not use them again. So they may be reused, otherwise we'll be running out of disk space very fast. So when you create a new file, you basically get an MFT entry which was marked as free. And when you write new content to that file, then it overwrites leftovers of a deleted file on the free space on the disk.
You may be familiar with scrubbers, like the ones that put ones and zeros over a file that's been deleted so that it can't be recovered. Is that what he's talking about?
Yeah, that's the difference between deleting and wiping, because you need to delete the content itself.
So a wiper, it's much more dangerous in that it uses a trusted entity on the system, and in this case it's EDR or AV, to complete its malicious actions. by proxy. For this demonstration, Orr used the Aikido Wiper. And what it is doing, it's using the EDRs and AV to help you accomplish your goal of wiping the data off a given drive.
Basically, EDRs do not have the functionality to wipe files because, as we just mentioned, in order to wipe files, we need to really overwrite the data itself. But they do have the ability to delete files. And as I said, it can be escalated to wipe things. So I realized that very standard feature in any antivirus or an EDR, I think the most basic one that we trust a lot and we never question is the feature that just deletes malicious files. And while this is good for us, it's a very powerful ability. And that is the exact ability that a wiper will be very happy to have. So I set a goal to see if I can somehow use that powerful ability.
According to Orr's blog post, there are two main events when an EDR deletes a malicious file. First, the EDR identifies the file as malicious, and then deletes the file. It's the in-between these two events, using junction links, that might be able to point the EDR towards a different path. These are called time of check-in and time of use vulnerabilities. So, how do you start by creating a malicious file?
This is not very difficult because when we talk about static signature-based detection, which is, I guess, what you're talking about, like when EDRs or antiviruses look at a file, determine if they have a signature that says, okay, this is a malicious file. So this is good against the common attacks that are not targeting us specifically and are not necessarily trying to bypass something and are just being spread in the world by evil people. Then most of these protection methods can be pretty easily bypassed. So for example, as part of the attack flow that we'll probably get into soon, we need to create a malicious file. And that means that we need to have this content somewhere. So you would ask, okay, so if as part of the exploit, the wiper needs to have the content of a malicious file which is about to be created, then that content is probably embedded in the code of the wiper itself too. So how come it's not detected when the wiper is first deployed before it actually exploits the vulnerabilities? So this was actually very easy to bypass. All that I needed to do is just to place a variable in a wiper that does hold the contents of a malicious file or just the ACAR test file, which is a file that antiviruses and EDRs are obligated to delete. All that I needed to do is just to XOR every byte in the malicious file with just some random value. And then when I really want to create the malicious file, just XOR it back with the same value. And then I have the content. So no EDR can guess that some random buffer that doesn't mean anything because it was XORed with a random value is actually a malicious file.
Let's just say, as an unprivileged user, I want to delete a .sys file, which is a driver contained inside the directory c/windows/system32/drivers. Of course, as an unprivileged user, I can't delete that file. But I can create a special path that is very similar to the path that I want to delete, with one main difference. Most of the path is contained inside a directory that is under my full control as an unprivileged user. In this case, it would be c/temp/windows/system32/drivers. And I created the .sys file at this location. Since it's important, I asked Orr to define the difference between the different links and why that's so important.
In the NTFS file system, we have three types of links. We have symbolic links, junction points, and hard links. Symbolic links are basically kind of a file that keeps a pointer to the file that it targets. So it's a pointer to a certain file. It can be either a directory link or a file link. But junction points are not like a pointer to the original file, but they are an extra pointer to the actual content. So it's not two stages, it's just one, immediately to the content itself, just like hard links. This is the raw difference between them. But when it comes to vulnerabilities and permissions to create them, then it is known that symbolic links have been the cause for a lot of vulnerabilities in the past. And so Microsoft did create a user right, which is given only to administrators by default for creating symbolic links. That user right is called the Create Symbolic Links user right. But junction points are just allowed to be created with no special permissions. And junction points work exactly the same like a local directory symlink. In their insides, they work a little bit differently. But when you use them, you're just directed to the folder that they point to. So it made my life easy that junctions do not require these special permissions.
So the Akito wiper, it executes its malicious actions using the most trusted entity on the system, the EDR.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that it's a vulnerability. Usually when you exploit something, then you exploit a vulnerability. I would say that it's just a feature which is not considered by Microsoft yet to be not safe, to be risky. So they didn't set up proper, I think, permissions to use them, to use that. So I can just use it. Like in older times, all symbolic links didn't require special permissions as well. But at a certain point, they came and said, okay, we need to have it because it's the cause for many vulnerabilities.
So is Akito a fileless attack?
No, so it's not a fileless attack. When you run a fileless attack, you just don't have any file from the attacker present on the computer. It's just an attack that does not touch its target files on its own, and it triggers the EDR, the antivirus, to do that instead.
Right. So Orr is turning it on itself. In his second talk, he talked more about storage systems in the cloud.
I wanted to find a program that is fully legitimate for doing mass file operation, but in the same time, it can be influenced by something that cannot be traced back to me, the attacker, that I triggered the file operation. So I just started thinking which programs can function as such a double agent. And I realized that local agents of cloud storage services would be probably best for it, because they usually create a local directory or a drive which is continuously synchronized with the cloud storage. So that means that on the one hand, they are considered legitimate for continuously changing files on the machine, on the local machine, because they need to always be synchronized with the files on the cloud. And on the second hand, you can just do a change in the cloud storage while you don't even run on the computer, and then the local agent will pull these changes and do them on the local computer, and that just leaves no traces.
And this is a chain attack. You have to go through several steps to get to the end result, one of which is obtaining an access token.
I wanted to empty the recycle bin from files that I first encrypted and then deleted, because as part of the attack flow, files are being uploaded to OneDrive, and OneDrive has a file versioning feature that saves 500 previous versions of files. And I knew that if I leave these versions there, then a victim could just recover using these versions. So I needed to get rid of them. And the only way was to first delete the encrypted files on the cloud storage and then empty the recycle bin. so they'll be really gone. And in order to do that, I saw that first Windows, the local OneDrive Windows agent just does not have a way to empty the recycle bin. It just opens the browser if you want to empty it. And when I looked at how the OneDrive browser version works, then I saw that it uses a completely different API for emptying the recycle bin, which was really, it was just very different from how, from the API that was used to modify or change files. And I saw that in order to empty the recycle bin, you must have a cookie that is called WLLSC, I think, which I probably helps to verify that you are currently in a web Microsoft session with your Microsoft account. And it just seemed that it is not possible to do that without the cookie. And I could potentially steal the cookie from the browser's cookie file, but this is an action which is very well known in endpoint protection platform really monitor for it. And it could not be a part of a fully undetectable attack. So instead, I went into the mobile OneDrive app in Android because I knew that mobile apps don't tend to use cookies. And in addition, it is sometimes considered a poor experience to open a web view or a web browser in the app. So I thought that it might be good to check there because maybe it doesn't use the cookie. Maybe there is a different API. So I went into the Android app. I saw that I can really empty the recycle bin from the app itself without any browser or web view opening. And then when I checked the actual HTTP requests, I saw that it really does not use the cookie, and instead it does not use the result having the cookie, but that is less relevant. In the end, if you empty the recycle bin from the web browser, you need to cookie. But with the flow of the HTTP request from the Android app, what you need is only the access token that I was able to steal from OneDrive's logs on Windows. So that basically meant that with the same access that as an attacker, I had to encrypt files and delete them in the first place, I could also empty the recycle bin, which is meant to be a security feature, which is an anti-ransomware feature. So that really didn't make sense.
So wait, so every file has 500 previous versions associated with it. And you first go in and you wipe all that out and it goes into the recycling bin. Then you have to empty the recycling bin. There's nothing then that someone can do to recover those files.
So basically, this attack can be done in two ways. It depends on how you really want to invest in the fact that the files will really, really will not be recoverable. So the first option you have, because you just have to get rid of the previous versions, you have to delete the files and empty them from the recycle bins. The files that were uploaded to OneDrive as part of this process, because their original version is there. So this is a process that you must go through. But then if you just keep it like that, then all of the files are gone and this is just a wiper attack. So you can use it as a wiper attack too, but if you want it to be a ransomware, then the only difference is that you present the encrypted files to the victim. So in order to do that, you need to just upload the files back to the same directory in the cloud storage, which means that they are then also coming back to the same local directory on the computer. This is why you need to delete the files. But the first stage of the attack, which you first just encrypt the files from the cloud storage before you even deleted them and emptied them from the recycle bin, is because of the fact that we want to make sure that the files are really not recoverable from MFT entries which were marked as free. Because if we just start by deleting all the files and then emptying them from the recycle bin on the cloud, then we won't have a way to overwrite the actual content which was left on the disk. But if we start with just encrypting them, then we overwrite the content which was there. potentially we can also not encrypt them, just download them to the attacker's computer, do the encryption there, but on the first stage just write random data to the files before we delete them.
So there's a nuance here. There's the wiper, which is a malicious attack, and you cannot recover its data. And then there's the ransomware, where I'm understanding that there's a lot of value in extorting the secrets contained within the data.
This is really, I think, the more strategic and psychological side of the things, you know? If we're talking about both attacks, potentially they both can be altered to be a wiper or a ransomware. You can change them, because if you can run a ransomware in the way that I showed, and you start with initial access on the target computer, then it means that you can also potentially just download the files that you're going to wipe first, then have them just in your computer and have the wiper runs and do all of the wiping, and then just upload the files back to the victim's machine as encrypted. And you can do that with the OneDrive ransomware, like I mentioned before. You can turn it to be just a wiper and not show the victim the encrypted files. So yeah, I think the part extorting or not is just depends on the actor, depends on the goals.
I guess I'm thinking of something like the Shamoon wiper, which was purely malicious. It destroyed so many machines for Saudi Aramco.
Yeah, so wipers usually by definition are meant to just do damage, you know? This is the difference between a wiper and a ransomware mostly. Yeah, I would guess that if it was not meant to be purely malicious and just do damage, then they would probably design it like a ransomware instead.
So Orr mentioned shadow copies. Can you explain that concept a little bit?
Just like you have previous versions of files in OneDrive, you have a feature built into Windows that is called shadow copies. Basically, you can create a shadow copy for a volume on your hard drive, and then in a sophisticated way stores previous versions of files from the moment that you took the shadow copy. So if files were wiped or got encrypted, then you can just restore a previous version of the files that were gone. So, of course, ransomware and wipers usually want to delete shadow copies.
Okay, so the user would know about that. They're not really shadow. It's just like, it's kind of a known secret.
It's not a secret. I think the shadow copies, it's like the word shadow is there because of the way it works. And yeah, it's just its name.
But is that the target of an attack? Do you want to delete those?
Yes, you can just think of it as a backup. So you want to delete all backups, so the victim won't be able to recover.
I'm wondering if there are any limits on your proof of concept here. I'm thinking that an organization may have petabytes of data. Would this scale?
It really, really depends on the setup, you know, on the situation, the internet speed, because yeah, eventually, if we're talking about the OneDrive ransomware, which I named Double Drive, then you do need to go through the process of first waiting for OneDrive to upload all the target files to the cloud storage. And then after deleting them from the attacker's computer, upload them back again. So it's probably not take a moment, but if the setup has good internet connection, then you can reach a lot of content in each endpoint. Also, when we're talking about an organization, and when you say petabytes, it's not petabytes in each computer. So if we're talking about the whole organization, then if we're talking, let's say, I'm just throwing a number here, but like 1,000 computers, then in each computer we have OneDrive, which will do all the uploadings in the same time. So it's not really about how much data is in the organization, but more how much data is in the computer.
Okay, that's fair. So we've talked a lot gloom and doom here. What is some of the positive takeaways that we're supposed to have from these two talks?
I think it really connects back to how I think about these attacks. And I think that the most important lesson is that we can't keep just trusting certain stuff and looking only at the stuff that we already know that can be risky. We need to start questioning everything, because this is the world that we live in right now. So it's good that we have security products that protect us, because they do protect us a lot. There are many things that they stop. It's good that we have OneDrive to back up our things and have previous versions of files. But we cannot say, okay, I have a security product, or I back up my files in OneDrive, so I'm safe. I'm immune. This is not the state. We need to always have multiple options to recover. We need to question everything and say, even if I have a security product, this can go wrong, so I need to have this instead.
In general, now the vendors have responded and/or indicated that some of them did in fact issue updates, while others, well, they're being more secretive about it.
In general, most security vendors really wanted to improve. They were really happy of their report and saw a good way to improve their products and help their customers. And so overall, most of them issued fixes and developed newer detection methods and fixed problems that fix their vulnerabilities. And this will not be the end, you know? I have many more things that are upcoming. Now it's the next things that I'm working on are not in the exact same area. It's not, again, using something standard and legitimate to do bad things, but you'll be hearing.
I want to thank Orr for talking about this interesting idea of his, that is, taking trusted EDRs and cloud backups and turning them against you. It's an intriguing idea, and one that the vendors are actually taking seriously. Orr reported that several fixes and workarounds had been issued, which is great, which is wonderful. That's what you expect from the industry. Still, this is a very clever mind that Orr has, and I look forward to talking to him again in the future about other ways to exploit the uncommon. Hey, if you're enjoying Error Code, tell a friend. I'm sure there are other people out there who like narrative information security podcasts. And I'd really like to hear from you. Join us on Discord. Search for Error Code Podcast to join the server, or go to errorcodepodcast.com to get more details. And tell me what you like, and even what you don't. Hey, I've got some great episodes coming up, including cyber risk management with IoT and OT, more on quantum computing, and why we need to secure ICS SCADA systems in the cloud. Subscribe today. I don't want you to miss out.